okay? This is still Dr. Rembert Luthaus.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome back to you as well. Okay. So, I was told you all want to encounter some texts, and so I thought to read together something from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. I may just say something in a moment. Get you a feel of what these texts are like. You'll see they're actually, if you've never read any of these texts, they're probably not quite what you expected. They're a lot of fun, actually. They're not just sort of abstract thinking, but there's some very interesting stories in there. And the way I want to do this is, you can interrupt me at any time you want, and you can comment on what we're reading, you can comment on what other people have been saying, and so on. So it's kind of a open floor for all of you. And occasionally I'll ask you to sort of some specific questions on what we're reading to help you make sense of it. Okay, just a brief introduction to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. It's the longest of the principal Upanishads. It's in translation about 100 pages long, so it's a lot of the Upanishads are much shorter. Can you hear me in the back, actually?
Yes.
A lot of the Upanishads are much shorter. Some are as short as just a little over a dozen verses. And so the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya are the two longest Upanishads, and they're both about the same length, about 100 pages each in translation. And it's most scholars will say that the Brihadaranyaka is the oldest of the Upanishads as well. And it's an Upanishad that's associated with the Yajurveda, which is the main ritual text, if you remember. You have four Vedas, but the primary ritual text there is the Yajurveda, which is always involved in every sacrifice. If the sacrifice gets more complex, you add the Rig Veda recitation to it. If the sacrifice gets even more complex, you add the Sama Veda to it. But the Yajurveda is always the basis of all ritual action. And so, as you can expect, because it's a text that's associated with the Ayurveda, there's a lot of talk on ritual, and often the context in which the stories and the teachings occur is a ritual context. As we'll see, the passage we'll look at today is from chapter 3 of the Brihadaranyaka, which is set in a sacrificial context. There's a sacrifice going to take place, and before the sacrifice actually gets going, there's going to be a big debate about the nature of the self and the nature of Brahman and so on. The main teacher in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is a person called Yajnavalkya. And Yajnavalkya is always portrayed in the Brihadaranyaka as a very wise person. He's married, he has two wives, which he at some point in the Upanishad he sort of leaves behind and becomes an ascetic. But in this passage that we're reading here, he's still married. He still has two wives, and but he's also a bit of an irreverent character. He's very sarcastic often, as we'll see, and he sort of likes to stir people a bit, sort of agitate people a little, and get them to think beyond what they're used to thinking, and. What you have here is a large chunk of chapter 3 of the Brihadaranyaka. The Brihadaranyaka has 6 chapters, and so this is kind of somewhere in the middle of the text. And it's the entire chapter is devoted to something that happens at the court of King Janaka. And King Janaka is a king of Videha. He's not the father of Sita, who is also called Janaka. It's a different Janaka. And he's known as a very wise king. He's a very learned person, and he often has debates and discussions with Brahmins about the nature of the self and about Brahman and sort of Upanishadic types of topics. And he, in a few instances, he himself actually teaches as well. He teaches Brahmins even, and that's how learned he's considered to be. And He's particularly fond of Yagyavalkya. There's a lot of discussions in the Brihadaranyaka between Janaka and Yagyavalkya. And so the story that you have there, I'll paraphrase the beginning a little bit. But the setting of the scene is Janaka is going to perform a big sacrifice. He's going to he's organizing a huge yagya, and the commentators are a bit sort of disagreeing on exactly what type of sacrifice it is. According to some, it's an Ashvamedha yagya, which is sort of the big royal sacrifice you can do to strengthen the power of the king. And because he's a king, because he's also very wealthy. There's a lot of people that come to his court when they hear he's going to perform this sacrifice. As I mentioned yesterday, in order to perform a sacrifice, you need to hire priests, you need to hire Brahmins who do the sacrifice for you. And so at the end of the sacrifice, once the Brahmins have done their job, then you have to pay them. And if you don't pay them, the Brahmanas, these Vedic texts are very explicit about this. If you don't pay the Brahmins at the end of your sacrifice doesn't count. And the better you pay them, the better the result will be that you get. And so here you have Janaka, this very wealthy king, who is going to perform a sacrifice. And so there's all these Brahmins that come to the court hoping to be chosen as the person to perform the sacrifice, so they would become wealthy. And the text says in the beginning there, Janaka, the king of Videha, once set out to perform a sacrifice at which he intended to give lavish gifts to the officiating priest, to the priest who do the yagya for him. Brahmins from the Kuru and Panchala regions had flocked there for the occasion, and Janaka of Videha wanted to find out which of those Brahmins was the most learned in the Vedas. Kuru and Panchala is further to the west. Videha is kind of, sort of Bihari, kind of Bihar Uttar Pradesh kind of area. But Kuru and Panchala is quite a distance away, actually. But the Brahmins of Kuru and Panchala in the Vedic texts are said to be particularly learned. They're, in the Upanishads, they're often referred to as very... There's sort of an intellectual hothouse there, and they're very learned people. And so all these Brahmins come, and Janaka decides, okay, I want to know which one is the most learned of these. And so what he says is he turns to the Brahmins, and he says, I have here 1,000 cows, and attached to the horns of each cow is 10 pieces of gold. So this is a lot of wealth that he's offering there. And he says, whoever is the most learned of you can take these cows away. Now you can imagine you have all these Brahmins that are gathered there from very distant regions, and it's a bit intimidating to kind of, no one wants to step forward and say, well, I'm obviously the most learned, so all these cows are mine. And so no one dares to do anything. Everyone is sort of apprehensive and shy and stays away. It's too arrogant a thing to do. But then Yagyavalkya wouldn't be Yagyavalkya if he turns to his student and he says, this is the second paragraph there, somewhere in the middle there, Samashravas, which is the name of his disciple, son, drive these cows away, take these cows, claim these cows as mine. And he drove them away. The Brahmins were furious and murmured, how dare he claim to be the most learned? What an arrogant fellow is this? Look at that. And the Brihadaranyaka continues and says, now Janaka of Videha had a Hotra priest, and a Hotra priest is a Rig Vedic priest. And so it's the priest that you hire to recite the Rig Veda in your ritual. And this Hotra priest was named Ashvala. And Ashvala approaches Yagyavalkya and he says, Yagyavalkya, do you really think you're the most learned amongst us? Is that what you're really thinking? And Yagyavalkya replies, he says, we bow humbly to the most learned most learned man. But we are really after the cows, aren't we? This is what we all want. It's like, who cares who's the most learned? We're all wanting the cows, so I'm just bold enough to take the cows for myself. And the text continues, at this, the Lord Ashvala became determined to question him. And what starts to happen then is Ashvala just starts to challenge him and to figure out, is this person really the most learned among the Brahmins present here? And he starts to challenge him. And it's the type of thing you find in a number of places in the Upanishads, where what you have here is not a student, a sort of a guru-disciple kind of instruction or relationship, but this is real debate. These are two people who are fighting with each other to figure out who is right and who is wrong, who's most learned, and who can defeat the other. And so it's a very charged atmosphere here. This is not sort of a submissive inquiry, as the Upanishads say, you should approach the guru, you know, submissively and inquire from them. This is really debate. This is a fight that's going to happen. And Ashwala quickly gets defeated. He realizes that Yajnavalkya actually does know more than I know. And he backs down, and there's a couple of other people that come forward, and they all sort of challenge Yajnavalkya, and Yajnavalkya always manages to say something that is beyond what they had understood. And so they always, the text says, they always fall silent. They kind of retreat and say, okay, you know, I'm not going to go further with this guy. You know, he's much more learned than I am. And so you see that the first part is, the text we just read is part one, and then the next one it says four. So there's three people that come before the next one that I want to look at that comes. And so then you have this person, Ushastha Chakrayana. Now Ushastha Chakrayana is a person we know from the Chandogya Upanishad. He's a Samaveda Brahmin. He was trained in the Samaveda. And he has a wife, and he's very poor. And that's what the Chandogya said. He's a very poor person, but he's very happy with his poverty, but his wife is not, and his wife is kind of nagging him to become a priest, become, you know, sort of function in a yajna so they can actually get some money and live. But Ashwala is kind of, Ushastha Chakrayana is always said to be content with his poverty, but he's also said to be very learned. And so he approaches Yajnavalkya and says, okay, he says, Yajnavalkya, he said, explain to me the Brahman that is plain and not cryptic, the self that is within all. Now the phrase, the Brahman that is plain and not cryptic is quite important. It's in the Vedic text, it's often said that the gods love that which is cryptic. Parokha kama ideva, the gods like that which is parokha, that which is difficult to perceive. And so you find a lot of passages in the Brahmanas and in the Aranyakas that give some very difficult interpretations of certain things and that sort of don't seem to make an awful lot of sense. And at the end you get this phrase, Parokha kama ideva, the gods like that which is cryptic, that which is obscure. And so Ushastha Chakrayana is very trained in these things. So it's okay, let's bring this down to human level, not to the level of the gods. So I really want to know whether you're more learned than I am. And he says, so what's this self that is within all? What's the Atman that is present in everyone?
Is Brahman and Atman, are they interchangeable? And what is the subtlety between the two? Are you here or anywhere else?
Good question. It's in the Upanishads, they're often used interchangeably. And the idea is that Brahman is the sort of the ground of all being. It's that, as we'll see, it's sort of the foundation of all existence. It is sat, it is existence itself. And so everything that exists is actually part of Brahman. That's the idea of the Upanishads. And that is often referred to by the term Atman as well in the Upanishads. And the idea is Atman literally means self. And so the Upanishads use the term Atman actually in a number of ways. Sometimes the term is used to refer to the body. Sometimes the term is used to refer to the prana, to the life air. Sometimes the term is used to refer to the mind and the thoughts that occur in the mind. And sometimes the term is used to refer to consciousness itself. And then sometimes it often actually goes beyond that and says actually the Atman is Brahman. Because that's where we really are. That's who we really are. That's where we really find our existence. Now, the exact relationship between these two then, if we as individual beings, how we relate to Brahman, that's centuries of debate on that. Some say, like Shankara, the 8th century Advaita Vedanta philosopher, he argued that the Atman and Brahman are sort of the individual self here is identical to Brahman in all respects. And so we have to realize that we are merely identifying with the body, and because we identify with the body, I see myself separate from you and from you and from you and from everything else. But once I realize I see through the illusion, then I see that everything is pure consciousness and we're all part of the same existence. Other interpreters of the Upanishads say, well, there is a oneness, there is a unity there, but it's not a complete unity. It's a oneness that doesn't lose its individuality. And so we're still individuals, even though we belong to the bigger thing. So it's kind of, if you want, Brahman is sort of the bigger thing in which you have a lot of smaller things, which are part of the bigger thing, but are still separate from the bigger, sort of still have their individuality. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So that's effectively a world for every self, because it's the perception of the individual self that creates the world, and yet they're all joined up.
Yeah. It's that's part of the difficulty. We all seem to sort of, as it were, inhabit our own world. We all have our own thoughts. We are all aware of our own things. We perceive the certain things that, you know, other people might perceive differently. And so the question is, in the Upanishads, is, so how do we relate them to each other? And we'll see, actually, the Upanishads put a lot of emphasis on the human person. And they generally, when they talk of Brahman and the Atman and so on, it's always from the perspective of a human being. It's never sort of from the perspective of God, as it were. It's always from our own point of view. And so there's a lot of discussion on perception, on seeing, on hearing, on tasting, on touching, on basically the things that we experience in this life. There's a lot of talk about food, about prana, about breathing, about thinking, and so on. And so that's always a perspective the Upanishads take. It's always from our own point of view, trying to understand how we relate to everything else and how we relate particularly to Brahman then. And so here, when you can see his question that Ushastha Chakrayana asked, he says, okay, please explain to me the Brahman, which is then the self that is within all. And so here he uses Brahman and Atman to refer to the same thing. Often in later texts, when the term Atman is used to refer to Brahman rather than to the individual self, the term Paramatma is used, the higher Atma, the supreme Atma. But it's basically, it's here, there's only a few places in the Upanishads where the term Paramatma is used. Generally just the word Atma is used, but with the sense of Paramatma, with the sense of the supreme self, which is where we find our real identity. And so, in other words, the Upanishads argue that if you just know yourself as pure consciousness, which is separate from the body, but you don't know God, however you conceive of God, you actually don't know yourself. That's the argument. And so therefore, God is your Atman. God is yourself, because that's where you ultimately belong. That's where you sort of put your part. And so Ushastha Chakrayana fires off this question and says, okay, teach me this plain and not cryptic, something that's obvious to everyone. So don't try to hide between fancy words and complex imagery and so on. Just give me the truth, plain and simple. And Yajnavalkya answers, he says, the self within all is the self of yours. So the self, the Atman that is present in everyone, is the same as that is within you. But Ushastha Chakrayana doesn't seem particularly pleased with it, and he says, which one is this self within all, Yajnavalkya? What is this exactly? And Yajnavalkya says, who breathes out with the out-breath, he is the self of yours that is within all. Who breathes in with the in-breath, he's the self of yours that is within all. Who breathes across with the intra-breath, he is the self of yours that is within all. Who breathes up with the up-breath, he's the self of yours that is within all. The self within all is the self of yours. Now, what do you make of this? What's Yajnavalkya getting at? What's he trying to say?
But the thing which is driving you to breathe, probably that is the self.
The life force?
The prana is the prana.
The prana.
It's not quite the prana that he's saying. So there's a prana is there, and we'll
it's
see.
It's the seal within, isn't that what it is?
Yeah.
Is that, it's the seal within.
So it's that which accompanies all the pranas that in there. So there's said to be five pranas. So the in-breath, the out-breath, the across-breath, the downwards breath, and the upwards breath. They're the airs that basically in the Upanishad said to animate the body. And so the body is kind of, you know, just dull matter that doesn't move of itself, but the prana kind of makes the so if I move my arm like this, this is the prana within it that makes the arm move. So we'll see there's a lot of connection made between prana and the self in the Upanishads, and particularly in Yajnavalkya's teachings. He's often talking about it in that sense. And so it's he who does he who breathes in with the in-breath, and he who breathes out with the out-breath. So that which sort of accompanies all the bodily functions of our body, that's the self that is, and that's the same in all the bodies. So that which animates my body, or that which animates the pranas within my body, which then animates my body, that's the same as the self that animates the pranas in your body, in everyone's body.
So that which differentiates between the inanimate and the animate.
In a sense.
Because...
So it's the generally, in the Vedic text, there's also a lot of talk of prana. And so the prana is generally conceived of that which animates the body. But Yajnavalkya is saying, okay, there's something beyond that. And so it's not just the prana that animates our body, but there's something else that animates the prana. And so that's my answer to your question. What's the self that is within all? But Rishastha Chakrayan is not very happy with this, as we'll see. And he replies, he says, that is a fine explanation. He's being very sarcastic here. That's a fine explanation. It's like saying, this is a cow and that is a horse. You know, it's totally evident to everyone what a cow looks like, what a horse looks like. He says, come on, give me a real explanation of the Brahman that is plain and not cryptic, of the self that is within all. So he says, you know, what you've been saying is totally obvious to every one of us here. This is just the most basic thing you could say. This is evident to everyone, like saying, you know, here's a cow and here's a horse. We all know this, so give me a real answer. Get further, get to the point. And remember, this is a debate. This is they're challenging each other. And Yajnavalkya, his reply again is the same. He says, the self within all is the self of yours. He gives the exact same answer he gave before. And Rishastha Chakrayan, you can sort of feel he's getting a little impatient with Yajnavalkya. He says, which one is the self within all, Yajnavalkya? Come on, give me an answer. And he says, you can't see the seer who does the seeing. You can't hear the hearer who does the hearing. You can't perceive the perceiver who does the perceiving. The self within all is this self of yours. All else besides this is grief. There's only sorrow. There's only suffering apart from this. And thereupon, Rishastha Chakrayan fell silent. He admits defeat and says, okay, Yajnavalkya knows what he's talking about. Now, what's he saying in this that's different from what he's saying in the previous passage? Rishastha was clearly not happy with the first answer Yajnavalkya gave him. So why would he be satisfied with this? What's Yajnavalkya getting at in here?
The one who drives his senses, the earlier was the breath, the other is more the senses.
Okay, but one could say, well, you know, whether it's the pranas or the senses, does that really make much of a difference?
He's clarifying much more that he has a force, the force unseen, which is different from the forces that are seen.
Beyond the prana.
Consciousness
within you is a consciousness.
Yeah.
It's a higher consciousness that is animating you as a being.
The first set was what trying to say what it is. The second is actually saying what it is not.
Very good. It's kind of some of the commentators on the text say that what Yajnavalkya is sort of implying in his second response is he's saying, Rishastha Chakrayana, what you're thinking of, what you want me to give as an answer, is something that I cannot give.
Yeah.
You're asking me something to pinpoint and say, okay, what is it exactly? But he says you cannot, because the self is not something like a cow or a horse. It's not some object that you can sort of just perceive and describe and so on. But he says it's... You can't see, you cannot see it, you cannot hear it, you cannot think of it, you cannot perceive of it. But then, on the other hand, as some of you were saying, it's the power behind the seeing, it's the power behind the senses, behind our faculties of acquiring knowledge, But it's also it's also that which is perceiving the seeing happening, and so it's the consciousness that's kind of aware of what's perceiving. Now, the implications of this, of course, are quite important. It means that the self is not something that you can just know in the sense that I can know this bottle or this table or even another human being, or like a cow or a horse. It's not just an object that I can sort of study and analyze and perceive in this the way I can perceive things. And the negative part of Yajnavalkya's answer is very typical for him. We'll see throughout this chapter, he likes this negative talk. Other Upanishads are not so fond of this and like to describe the self and Brahman in more positive terms. But Yajnavalkya really loves all this negative stuff. And as we'll see at the very end of the chapter...
Was he French by any chance?
But then it means it all comes out of belief.
Well, then that's
because there's no external validation, there is no satisfaction. Therefore, it's just a matter of believing.
Well, is it? Is it?
Why would you say that? Where is the belief here?
Because it can't
be proven. We can't talk about it.
Saying it's the force behind the breath.
Yeah, but he's saying you can't.
You can't
you
see
can't
it.
See the force. You
that's
don't know the force exists. How do you know?
But you have to question what is behind. What is the alternative answer?
Nothing.
The alternative, yeah. It could be that it just is.
Well, but that is more. That is as much a belief as saying
yeah.
that there's nothing behind. So.
But you can't exist without that thing. So,
yeah.
Obviously there is some life force.
There's something. We don't know what it is. Just because you can't describe it. So I don't know how you go to belief.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big debate actually in the whole intuitive interpretation of the Upanishads. Is the self really something that's totally unknowable? Can we actually know the self? Is there a way we can acquire? Not since it said you can't see it, you can't hear it, you can't think of it, you can't perceive it. Perceive means sort of consciousness. That's what the Upanishads mean by perceive. You can't sort of be conscious of it, and so on, and so. It's kind of part of the analogy that's sometimes given is of the eye, the instrument of the organ of the eye, which cannot see itself. The eye is that which is doing the seeing, but the eye cannot see itself. And you might say, well, I can look at a mirror and I can see my eye in the mirror, and so the eye can see itself. But you're actually seeing a reflection of your eye.
That's Shakespeare.
You find it in the Upanishads as well. So the eye can never see itself. Maybe Shakespeare knew the Upanishads.
The eye sees not itself, but by reflection.
Yeah.
Is the concept of this force behind something like what in Chinese is the qi force? I mean, is that what it is?
I don't know enough of Chinese to sort of to make a meaningful comparison between that. But
seeing it can't be proved empirically, unless you've had a direct experience. It's bound to be a belief, like Wanjin's saying. Until then, it's a belief. Then there might be 20 other people who said the same thing over a 2,000 year period, without conferring, and they're all saying the same thing. So you say, okay, look, there might be something behind this. Like if 200 people go to a different country and come back, and they're all describing the same experience, and yet they haven't talked to each other. You say, okay, maybe that country exists. But for you, it's a belief because you've never been there.
Yeah, it's the way Vedantic thinkers who sort of base their entire thought on the interpretation of the Upanishads, the way they sort of would answer these issues is first they'll say, actually, the only way you can obtain knowledge about the self and about Brahman is through revelation. And so it's the Upanishads, they're the primary means for our source of knowledge. Because they argue that we have three ways by which we generally acquire knowledge. So we have pratyaksha, which is sense perception or direct experience. And so I see things, I taste things, I experience things in my life. And so I obtain knowledge from that. I look into this room and I see all of you are sitting here. And so from that I obtain knowledge that there are other people in this room.
What's the word you use?
Pratyaksha.
And that's experience.
experience.
So that, that include empirical evidence, like scientific evidence in a test tube, anything, anything physical?
Yeah. That they would include that in projection, which is basically experience or sense perception.
So these are ways of knowing.
Through the
senses we have today.
Yeah, and so I can look outside. I see there's sun there, and so I can sort of know, okay, it's day. I kind of
Pratyaksha.
Sorry,
what's your sense perception?
Sorry,
and then the other levels.
And then they say beyond that. There is, for example, there's another way I can obtain knowledge, and that is they call it anumana, which means inference. And for example, I might hear some of the students shouting and sort of having a sort of shouts of joy and so on. And so from that I can infer that they must have passed their examination or they must have finished their exam. At least they don't know yet whether they passed they finished their exams. And so I don't see the students, but I can infer that they're students who are probably covered in flour and all sorts of other things and champagne, as the students do here when they finish their final exam. And so I can infer that from hearing the noises. And so this is anumana, sort of inference, and sometimes it's used in a more broader sense to refer to reasoning in general, is another way I can obtain knowledge about things that are beyond the immediate range of my experience. And so I can, the standard example that is given in logical texts is, if I see smoke on the mountain, I can infer that there must be fire on the mountain, there must be some fire burning on the mountain, because wherever there's fire, there is smoke, and so if I see smoke, I know that there must be fire. And so that's, I don't see the fire, but I can infer that there must be fire. And then finally they say there's a third, which is shabda, which literally means sound, but it's kind of used in a technical sense to refer to testimony. And for example, my brother lived for many years in China and worked there. I've never been to China. I consider my brother a reliable source of information. I don't think he would cheat me or he would lie to me about what China is like. And I would perhaps assume that he's sort of a little unbiased towards these things. And so I can obtain knowledge about China from his testimony. And so again, it's beyond the range of my inference and beyond the range of my sensory perception. But I can obtain reliable knowledge about a place I've never been from somebody that I consider reliable who has been there. Now, there's a particular type of shabda, a particular type of testimony that they talk about, and that is scriptural testimony. And that's particularly the testimony of for the Vedantic traditions of the Upanishads. And so they say, what the Upanishad, if you remember when we talked yesterday about the two types of things that the Vedas said to teach. So some schools say it is karma, it teaches you about action, it teaches you about how you should live in this world. And some schools say it's about Brahman, it teaches you about the nature of reality, about nature of God, nature of the self, and so on. And both of these schools argue that what the scripture is teaching is something that cannot be proven, or sort of that cannot be, not proven is the wrong word actually, so that cannot be obtained by either inference or sense perception. And so those who say that the Veda teaches you about dharma, they'll argue that dharma is not something that you can see, dharma is not something that you can attain through just reasoning and inference, but it is something that you have to be told, basically. It's something that you have to be, that you know from revelation. That's what the, of course, you've just had a session on the Mahabharata. It's a lot more complicated than the Mahabharata, as you're probably very well aware now. But
so it's the equivalent of the word of God, in a sense, in the Bible or in the Quran. It's a revelation, it's a book of revelation.
Yeah, except that for generally the traditions that say it's all about dharma don't actually believe in God. there is no supreme being. And so the Veda is just this eternal text that is there and that sages perceive and sages kind of reveal to us, but that it's not created by anyone. It's not the word of God in that sense. And but for our purposes, the Vedantic schools say also that the knowledge of God is something, or the knowledge of Brahman is not something that you can obtain through sense perception and through inference, but it's something that you can only be taught by the Upanishads that teach you what it is. And the reason, the implications of that are very important, because it means that they say each of these means of knowledge has its own sphere, has its own domain. And so sensory perception, pratyaksha, its domain is the world around us. Inference as well is the world around us, but it sort of goes a little further. But they say Shabda, and particularly the Upanishads, do not teach us anything about that is covered by these other means of knowledge. Because if it did, then it would be redundant. If Shabda were teaching us, if the Upanishads were teaching us something that we can perceive through our senses or can come to reasoning, then it might as well not be there, because we can come to the same conclusions through other means. And so they say the uniqueness of these texts is that they can go beyond that and can reach beyond. Now, the flip side of that is true as well. A lot of the commentators say that if the Upanishads teach something that goes against our sense perception, or seems to teach something that goes beyond our sense perception, it is merely that we have not understood what the text is saying, because scripture cannot invalidate sense perception. And Shankara, for example, in many places in his writings, he's very emphatic, and he says, even if 100 Vedic passages say, declare that fire is cold and fire is dark, he says, we cannot take such a passage literally, because our experience teaches us that fire is light and fire is hot. And so we have to understand this in a different way than in a literal sense, because the range of scripture, the range of the Upanishads is not this world. The Upanishads are there to teach us about Brahman and about the self, which cannot be perceived in any other way. And so now, they would argue that this doesn't mean that this, in a sense, cannot be proven. They're not saying that, therefore, everything the Upanishads say about Atman and about Brahman is something that is illogical or something that goes against our sense perception. They're merely saying that sense perception and inference and reasoning cannot give us any definite answer to these questions. And so, for example, in the West, you have the Western theology of the cosmological argument for the existence of God, which is an argument that tries to establish through reason why there must be a creator of this world. And in Vedanta, this idea is rejected. They say, because you can't come to an understanding that, yeah, there must be a source of this world through reasoning, but exactly what that source is, what the cause of this world is, you cannot ascertain through inference. He says, maybe there were 5 gods who created the world. Maybe the person who created the world is dead. Maybe the person who created the world created it with bad intentions or good intentions. Or it just, they say, reasoning is limited. It can only get you to a certain point, and beyond that point, you have to go for something else in order to obtain knowledge about that. Now, they're saying, to say that something is beyond reason or beyond logic doesn't mean that it's illogic, and they're very emphatic on this. It just means that reason goes up until a certain point, and at that point, you have to give it up. But up until when you reach that point, reason is important. And so when they're commenting on the Upanishads, they're all kind of dealing, they're refuting each other's readings, partly on the basis of they're saying, what your interpretation of this doesn't make logical sense. And so there's a lot of emphasis on logic. They say, what you're saying sometimes even doesn't corroborate our experience in this world. But it's there's something beyond that. But up until a certain point, you have to follow these, basically. So it's not that it can't be proven. It just cannot be proven with certitude. Maybe that's not proven. You can't sort of ascertain it with certitude through sense perception or through inference. But you can indicate it through those. That's what they're arguing. And so something might be, what's the word? Something might be logical without it being fully proven by logic. It might corroborate the sort of basic rules of logic, but still going beyond it. That's sort of the way the Vedantists have sort of answered this.
And can you get to the last stage on your own, or do you need a guru?
Yeah, generally they'll say you need a guru. They'll argue you need a guru for a number of reasons. One is you need someone who... The Upanishads say, in order to know this, of course, you know, the people in the Upanishads, they're all, as we've seen, they're all Vedic ritualists, and they all have gurus. They all have people who taught them the Veda. As I mentioned yesterday, the Veda is memorized from an early age, and so it's basically, you don't have books of the Vedas. They're all oral texts, so they exist in the memory and in the recitation of people who've memorized the Veda. And so in order to learn the Veda, you need a guru. You need a guru who can recite the Veda for you, so you can repeat it, and then, you know, they basically go back and forth. So you say, Agni Mide Purohitam Yajasadevam Vithvijam, and the student goes, Agni Mide Purohitam Yajasadevam, and the guru might correct them when the pronunciation is wrong, and they just drill that in them. And so they all have gurus. But then in the Upanishads, you find this discussion in a number of places that, okay, in order to know the Atman, you need a different guru. You need a guru who's more than just knowing the Vedas. And so it's not just, you don't just need someone who can give you, basically tell you, okay, here's the text, and learn this, but you need also someone who's Brahmanishta, they say, someone who's himself grounded, literally, in Brahman, right? Who has himself experience of Brahman. And so therefore can make sense of these texts through, because it's corroborated by their own experience, and therefore can transmit the knowledge that is in there. And so they say, there's a lot of passages in the Upanishad that say, not by listening, which means we would translate that as reading, because we don't really listen to books anymore, generally, but we read books, but not through listening, not through argumentation, not through being taught by many people can the self be known, but it can also only be known through this sort of process of giving yourself to the guru in that relationship and being transformed by that relationship, and sort of being taught, being guided by the guru, and sort of coming to that knowledge.
Because I was thinking back to your point that a lot of the mystic poetry, whether it's Kabir and so on, most of Kabir's works are all about Shabda. Where
the testimony, my testimony.
My testimony, having been in bliss, in samadhi, this is what I experienced, suno bhai sadhu. So a lot of this, I think, it's not just gurus the way we understand them as Vedantic gurus, but most of the mystics, it's not just In Sufi traditions or Indian traditions, but even the Kabbalah, the mystics, Rumi, you find very, very similar texts coming out of this experience. That's why, back to Ranjit's point about where does acceptance begin and blind faith come in? It's a complex equation.
Yeah, the reason why sort of scripture and the Upanishads are so stressed in these traditions is they do talk about experience and so on. But they're also a little wary of experience. It's a little, you know, a lot of people experience very strange things. And so in a sense, they argue that scripture is there to kind of guide your experience, to kind of say, okay, this is the experience that, you know, the Upanishads are basically the records of the experience of the sages. And so this is the record of their experience. And your experience should be kind of in line with that. If your experience is very different from that, you're doing something wrong. And so that's why they emphasize the scripture. It's sort of a guideline to sort of give you a roadmap, as it were, that, okay, I'm sort of going in the right direction. Because we experience all sorts of things that are due to, you know, faulty, you know, things in our body. Our eyes are defective, or our brains might be defective, might have chemical imbalances in our brain that cause us to see wild hallucinations and so on. And so our experience is not always reliable. And so therefore they say it needs to be guided by this. And that's why you have the guru who has himself the experience, but is also grounded in these texts. And therefore you need someone who's Vedanishta and Brahmanishta, who's grounded in the Vedas, but also grounded in Brahman in his own experience of it. And only they can give you that knowledge, the Upanishads.
So it's only the testimony of somebody who is versed in the scriptures which can be...
You could be versed in...
No, and the experience of somebody, I think the testimony of somebody that you can take seriously is only that of somebody who has
is worse in the spiritual than as I have that experience.
In general, the Upanishads would say yes, but
yeah.
there are exceptions.
Exception.
but yeah. You have to have faith. You have to have faith in that, this process. So
yeah.
You have to have faith that if you engage in this process, which is one could be meditation, could be dharma, living a life of dharma, that if you go on that lonely road, it's for some people, that it's going to lead to illumination.
Mm.
But then how does the guru is just there to encourage you down that road, is that it, or to...
To kind of guide you, and there's a beautiful passage in the Chandogya Upanishad that says it's like a man who's taken from Gandhara, from modern Afghanistan, and blindfolded and taken far away somewhere into the desert, and it's sort of that is left behind there, and the man is kind of stumbling, and he's still blindfolded, and he doesn't know where he's going, and he says, until somebody comes and takes off his blindfolds and says, Gandhari is over there, it's you have to walk in that direction. And he says, the man, once he's set on his way, then he can start walking in that direction. But the Chandogya says, whatever village he passes through, he should ask, is Gandhara still that way? You know, am I still going in the right way? And he says, and the Chandogya says that once the blindfolds are taken off of the man and he's sort of set on his way, the man comes to the understanding that I've already arrived home, even though I'm still, he's still wandering in the desert, but he's already arrived home back in Gandhara, but only time is separating him from achieving that. And the Chandogya tells that story, or uses that analogy to say, this is why you need somebody who can take off the blindfold, give you some insight into things, and set you on your way, and say, okay, this is how you should live, this is how you should understand, this is who you are, and now just keep going in that direction. But keep relying on other people as well to kind of check, am I still going in the right place? Is Gandhara still in that direction?
It can also be in the form of a revelation or something else, not necessarily a human guru.
Continuous
revelation and dynamic revelation.
But there are stories of people who mentored at that time.
Yeah.
Realization without a guru.
Yeah.
Like did Ramana Maharshi have a guru? I don't know, but I didn't think so. I think you thought he went crazy at the age of 16, left the home,
Yeah, in the Upanishads, the Upanishads are actually very emphatic on the need for a guru. And there's a story that's told in the Chandogya where you might know the story of Satyakama, the boy who sort of doesn't know who his father is, and he tells the truth to his guru, who asks him, well, so who's your father? He says, well, my mother doesn't know. And he says, well, therefore you're a Brahmin, because you spoke the truth, and therefore I can teach you. And the story kind of develops, actually. Satyakama, what his guru does, he says, okay, here, take these cows and go and herd these cows, which was a general task assigned to the disciples, to the students. And so he goes off with the cows, and Satyakama takes a sort of a vow, and he says, I will not come back to my guru until I have, 1,000 cows, until they've multiplied to 1,000 cows. And while he's away, the cows are kind of multiplying, and there's calves being born, and it seems he's away for a few years. And the day the 1,000th cow is born, he decides, okay, now I can go back to my guru, I can make my guru proud. And that night, he's instructed by there's basically the fire that he has sort of built at night is instructing him, and then there's a bird that's instructing him, and another bird that's instructing him, and a bull that's instructing him. And he comes back to each of them teaches him a quarter about Brahman. And he comes back to his guru's ashram, and his guru says, wow, you glow with the light of someone that has known Brahman. And so what happened? And so Satyakama tells the story. He says, well, this was how I was taught by these. But then Satyakama says, he says, I know that the knowledge is not complete unless it is taught by a guru. So please teach me all of that again. And so then his guru teaches him basically the same thing that all these, these animals and so on have taught him, And then he says, okay, now you go. And that's sort of the end. So the Upanishads are more emphatic on the need of the guru than the, some of the later traditions are. But anyway, if we go, get back to the text. The Ushastra Chakrayana has been taught that the self is beyond our perception, because it's that which is doing the perception. It's that which empowers it. The ears themselves, the eyes themselves, they're dead. They cannot perceive anything, but they have to be animated by something in order for that to perceive. So when we're dead, when there's a corpse, the senses don't perceive anything because they're dead in themselves. There's something beyond it. And then the debate gets a bit a lot more interesting, actually. The next person that comes forward is Gargi Vachaknadi. And this is a woman. And there's a number of female sages mentioned in Vedic texts. There's over 20 mentioned in the Rig Veda, which is kind of interesting because normally, sort of, as the tradition develops, women are not allowed to study the Veda and so on, but it seems there were people, female persons, who were studying these texts. Amongst the commentators, there's a lot of debate on what Gargi actually is, whether she's married, whether she's not married, and most argue she's not married. But then there's a debate on, or she's no longer married, according to some. Some argue she's a widow, her husband has passed away. Some argue she's actually an ascetic. She'd chosen not to be married, and she lives an ascetic life.
Why is that relevant?
I don't know, but they seem to.
She must be married. She's asking the weird question.
Obviously, the company is rubbing off.
I think actually part of the reason why they find it important to stress that she's not married is because she's not, as we'll see, exemplifying the life of a sort of a submissive wife, as is often portrayed in the text. She's very fierce, as we'll see. And so maybe they sort of feel uncomfortable with the idea that that's somebody's wife, and therefore they sort of feel like, okay, she has to be sort of independent somehow. But we'll see. It's tied in with the way the story develops, actually, whether the fact that some argue she's an ascetic, she's renounced the world. And so she comes forward and she questions him. She says, Yajnavalkya, tell me, since this whole world is woven back and forth on water, on what then is water woven back and forth? And this is an image that is also found often in Vedic texts. It's the idea is you have, so if you're weaving, you have a block here, so there's threads that are attached to these things, and so when you're weaving, you basically sort of go through it this way, and 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 this way, you weave a cloth. Now, these are the threads on which the cloth is woven, and so the question, it's sort of an image that is often found in Vedic texts, on what is something woven back and forth, meaning what's the foundation of something, what holds something together, what's kind of keeping the cloth together, it's these threads. If you pull out these, then the whole cloth unravels. And so she said, okay, water is sort of the basis of all existence, so what's the foundation of water? And you'll see it gets fairly Upanishadic here. Perhaps the sequence is not entirely clear. But he says, Yajnavalkya says, well, water is woven on air, Gargi. On what then is air woven back and forth? On the worlds of the intermediate region. It's the region between earth and heaven. It's sort of the sky, basically. On what then are the worlds of the intermediate region woven back and forth in the worlds of the Gandharvas, and then those are woven onto the worlds of the sun, and the worlds of the moon, the worlds of the moon on the stars, on the gods, on Indra, on Prajapati. And finally, she says, on what then are the worlds of Prajapati woven back and forth? Prajapati is a deity that's mentioned often in Vedic texts, and these exact identification is difficult. Later traditions identify with various beings. Some say it's Brahma, some say it's Vishnu, some say it's Vishnu, Shiva, and so on. But it's not entirely clear. The Upanishads, the Vedas and the Upanishads just use the term Prajapati, which literally means the Pati, the lord of the Prajas, the creature, the things that are born. And so, on what is that world, what's the foundation of that world? And he says, on the worlds of Brahman, Kali. On what then are the worlds of Brahman woven back and forth? At this point, Yajnavalkya told her, don't ask too many questions, Gargi, or your head will shatter apart. You're asking too many questions about a deity about whom one should not ask too many questions. So, Gargi, don't ask too many questions. Thereupon, Gargi Rajak.
Isn't that a
As Madhu says, she's reached the end of the reasoning.
It's actually interpreted in both ways. Some commentators say this is really a cop-out. And some actually argue he's treating her in this way because she's a woman.
Both are bad.
And some argue that he's actually making the point that you were making at the end. That you're asking, sort of, you're trying to find something through reasoning that is beyond reasoning. And so don't ask too many questions about them. Don't start sort of reasoning about this too much, because this is beyond reason. And now the question is of course, what's Brahman here? And the problem is the Sanskrit basically says Brahma Loka, the world of Brahma. And Sanskrit, at least with some terms, is very ambiguous. And Brahma, particularly when it's in a compound, can mean pretty much a whole range of things. It can mean Brahman, as Brahman we've been talking about, but also, as it is in English, it's often translated as Brahma, Brahma Vishnu Shiva, but it could also be a Brahman, that's also just the word Brahma. Most commentators argue that what is talked about here is Brahma, of the triad. So it's the creator of the world, so the
source.
The source of the world. And so what's beyond that would be Brahman. Yajnavalkya is saying you can't ask questions beyond this, because then you're, with Brahma you're still within this world, but when you go beyond Brahma and you go to Brahman, then you're beyond this world, and so therefore logic and reasoning doesn't work. But the story gets a lot more interesting after that. We'll see Gargi Vajaknavi, she falls silent, but she's not satisfied with this. She doesn't admit defeat, as we'll see.
Sounds familiar. What I find interesting is the logical build-up it's water, air, Gandharva, sun, moon. I mean, in a way, you see the inanimate to the consciousness there, but the order is somewhat strange.
Yeah, the order in a way sort of parallels the order you find in some texts of sort of the hierarchy in the world, sort of higher and higher realms. It doesn't fully correspond to it, but it's kind of...
I think it's very logical. I can see the sequence.
Okay.
No, but then... but you see black and white, you see...
Yeah, I'm just surprised where the Gandharvas fit into this. I mean, the sun, moon, all have some sort of rod of
angels. Angels,
the being. Musical being.
We'll see if the Gandharvas come back in the next section. And they're not exactly sort of angelic in their behavior, as we'll see. They're often said to possess people. the challenge that, or the warning that Yajnavalkya gives Gargi here, that your head will shatter apart, is something that you find in a number of texts, and it's actually taken literally, as we'll see. We won't get there. But at the very end of the chapter, there's one person who's challenging Yajnavalkya, and in the end of the debate, his head does explode. And the idea of it is in the Upanishads is that if you're speaking beyond your realization, if you're speaking about something of which you have no knowledge, and if then, and this is an important sort of qualification, and if somebody warns you about this devil, and you just keep talking beyond your realization, your head will explode.
How come we've never seen it happen?
Mortal synonym would be a hemorrhage.
You lose your mind.
But also that you keep debating within yourself, so you keep at that.
No, but if you cross the threshold of your capability,
if it's metaphorical, maybe that person has gone beyond thought at that moment. Maybe that person has suddenly been liberated.
I would be inclined to say if you take it not literally, it would mean you go mad.
Metaphorically,
But the very last person that challenges Yagyavalkya is a person called Shakali. We won't get to him now, but I give you the passage where he's talking. And Yagyavalkya, he challenges Yagyavalkya, and he's asking all these questions. And it's a really long, it's the longest discussion that is there in this chapter. And at some point, Yagyavalkya turns the tables and he says, "You're asking me all these questions, now let me ask you some questions." And he starts asking questions to Shakalya. And Shakalya is in the Upanishads always presented as a very arrogant person, a person who doesn't really know what he's talking about. And at some point, Yagyavalkya says, "Do you know the answer to these questions? If you don't, your head will fall apart." And if you look to the very end, actually, it's kind of an interesting passage there. The very final paragraph you have there. It says, "Shakalya did not know him, did not know the answer to the question, and his head did indeed shatter apart. Robbers, moreover, stole his bones, mistaking them for something else." Yagyavalkya then addressed the Brahmins that are present there, and he says, "Distinguished Brahmins, if any of you would like to question me, let him do so. Or, if you prefer, you may question me altogether, or else if any one of you would like me to, I will question him. Or if you prefer, I will question all of you together." But those Brahmins did not. And that's how the chapter ends. So the head exploding or shattering is taken quite literally, as you can see. I just want to kind of go back to the Gargi and sort of see her return, because there's some interesting things in the remaining time we have. And we won't get into all the teachings that are given there, but just to finish the story. And so Gargi, Yagyavalkya basically tells her, "Shut up, don't ask too many questions. If you do, you'll die." And the next person that comes in 7 there is Udalaka Aruni. Now, Udalaka Aruni is the chief, the principal teacher of the Chandogya Upanishad. And throughout the Upanishads, he's said to be a very learned man and also a very kind man. He's a very cultured and very sort of gentle person, but very learned as well. And in some texts, he's actually said to be the teacher of Yagyavalkya. And so he's superior to Yagyavalkya. And Udalaka Aruni kind of comes forward after he's sort of told Gargi not to ask any more questions about Grahman. And he says, "Yagyavalkya," he said, "once we were living in the land of the Madras," which is further west as well. It's not Madras, but South India. "Learning about the sacrifice in the house of Potenchalakavya." He had a wife, there's a woman there, possessed by a Gandharva. So here you see the sort of not so kind natures of the Gandharvas. "We asked him who he was, and the Gandharva said that he was Kavanda Atharvana," about which we don't know anything. "He then asked Patanchala Kapya and the students there who were learning about the sacrifice, 'Tell me, Kapya, do you know the inner controller of this world and the next, as well as of all beings who control them from within?' And Patanchala Kapya says, 'I don't know this person.' And then the Gandharva teaches him. And then if you turn the page, he says, Udalaka Aruni says, 'And I know it. I know this inner controller. I know this Antaryami. I know this being.' So if you drive away the cows meant for the Brahmins, if you've taken all these cows that Janaka was ready to give to the most learned Brahmin, so if you claim to be the most learned person, Yagyavalkya, without knowing who that inner controller is, your head will shatter apart." And so This is very untypical for a Dalek, because a Dalek is always a gentle person. But here he's getting quite fierce. And so he turns the tables on the Abulas and says, if you don't know the answer to this question, your head will explode. And he says, Gautama, which is a family title of Udalek, he says, I do know who that inner controller is. And Udalek says, of course, anyone can say, I know. Tell us what precisely you know. So merely saying, I know, merely saying, I'm the most learned person will not do. You have to prove this to me. Now, what is Udalek doing here? What's different about the way he approaches Yajnavalkya from the others? There's a very important, there's a change here from the way Gargi approached him, from the way Shasta approached him, and so on.
Challenges.
He's challenging.
Trade-off. Your head will shatter.
Yeah, but why can he do that?
Because he's senior to him.
He's senior to him. And also, I mean, seniority itself would not be enough. He has more knowledge than Yajnavalkya. So he can act as a judge. He can say, I can judge you, Yajnavalkya. And a lot of the commentators argue that Udalika is really upset by the way he's treated Gargi. And he thinks the way Yajnavalkya treated Gargi was totally inappropriate. And so he's stepping in and he's saying, okay, you've treated her in that way. Now let me treat you in that same way. And let me see whether you actually, whether your threat was actually legitimate. Udalek, Yajnavalkya answers this question. It's a very long passage that's actually fairly repetitive. That we'll skip because we won't have time for it. But it's basically touching on the same thing he told Ushastha Chakrayanis. It's that which is beyond the things we perceive in the world, that which is beyond our sense of sight, our sense of hearing, and so on. He concludes, if you turn the page, with the same thing. He sees the antaryami, the self that is within, Brahman that is within us. He sees, but he can't be seen. He hears, but he can't be heard, and so on. And such, he just repeats that same teaching as he gave Ushastha Chakrayana. So he's not an object that we can perceive, like we can perceive anything in this world. All besides this is greed. Thereupon, Udalek Aruni fell silent. He admits defeat. Or not defeat here. In this case, he said, okay, I'm satisfied with your level of knowledge. It's fine. I'll leave you at that. And then immediately after that, Gargi comes back, perhaps because she sort of feels strengthened by Udalek Aruni, that he sort of stepped forward to defend her. And she comes back, and her mood is totally different. And she says, first thing she does is she turns to all the Brahmins that are there. She says, distinguished Brahmins, I'm going to ask this man, Yajnavalkya, two questions. If he can give me the answers to them, none of you will be able to defeat him in a theological debate. And Yajnavalkya says, ask, Gargi, challenge me. And she says, I rise to challenge you, Yajnavalkya, with two questions. Much as a fierce warrior of Kashi or Videha, stringing his unstrung bow and taking two deadly arrows in his hand, would rise to challenge an enemy. Give me the answers to them. This is getting very, very tense there. She compares herself with a warrior of Kashi and Videha, which are said to have some of the best warriors around, with two deadly arrows, two arrows that can kill. And so again, it's sort of implying, if you don't know the answer to these questions, this is the end of you, which means also she's very confident. She's very confident about herself. Yajnavalkya has challenged her and said, if you don't know the answer, you're asking too many questions, you're speaking beyond your realization, but she's very confident, I'm not. I know what I'm talking about. And Yajnavalkya, I'd like to think very calmly, said, ask, Gargi, go ahead. And she said, the things above the sky, the things below the earth, and the things between the earth and the sky, as well as all those things people here refer to as past, present and future, on what Yajnavalkya are all these woven back and forth? It's a similar question to the one she's been asking the first time, slightly different formulation. And he replies, on the things above the sky, the things below the earth, and the things between the earth and the sky, as well as all those things people here refer to as past, present and future, on space, Gargi, are all these woven back and forth. Everything we have here exists in space. It is sort of the first thing that is created in the sequence of creation is space. There's everything has dimensions here in this world. So That's the first element. And she responds. Sorry? Is she happy?
She's
not. What's all honor to you, Yagyavaki. You really cleared that up for me. Get ready to accept it. And then,
did you mean sarcastic?
Yeah, it's very sarcastic. At least, and then she says, she asks another question, says, ask Garki, and she asks the exact same question. And what are all these things woven back and forth? Yagyavati gives the exact same answer. And there's some debate among commentators whether this is actually her second question or not. And some argue that the all honor to you, Yagyavati, you really cleared that up for me. It's very sarcastic, and therefore she's saying, you know, what kind of an answer is that? I'll ask the same thing again, and just to emphasize the point that this is really ridiculous. Some commentators, Shankara, for example, argues that she's being very sincere here, and she says, okay, you've actually clarified this for me, and that the question she repeats is not her second question, but it's just she restates this for emphasis, to emphasize the point of this. And then her second question is what comes after that, on what then is space woven back and forth? And he says, that Gargi, so what's the foundation of everything that is the foundation of this world? And he says, that Gargi is the imperishable. And Brahmins refer to it like this. It is neither coarse nor fine. It is neither short nor long. It is neither blood nor fat. It is without shadow or darkness. It is without air or space. It is without contact. It has no taste or smell. It is without sight or hearing. It is without speech or mind. It is without energy, breath, or mouth. It is beyond measure. It has nothing within it or outside of it. It does not eat anything, and no one eats it. So again, the very negative, sort of the negative language, what everything that it is not. It is not this, it is not that. The very final thing he teaches Shakali, whose head then explodes, is the only thing you can say about Brahman is Neti. Not this, not this. We're going a bit over time. Is that okay? Let's read the two short paragraphs. This is the imperishable Gargi, after that. At whose command the sun and the moon stand apart. This is the imperishable Gargi, at whose command the earth and the sky stand apart. This is the imperishable Gargi, at whose command seconds and hours, days and nights, fortnights and months, seasons and years stand apart. This is the imperishable Gargi, at whose command rivers flow from the snowy mountains in their respective directions, some to the east and others to the west. This is the imperishable Gargi, at whose command people flatter donors, and gods are dependent on patrons of sacrifice. The donors here are the people who pay the Brahmins at the end of the sacrifice. So the Brahmins flatter them so they would get more. And say, oh, you're such a nice person, you're so wealthy, and so wonderful, and then they'd be, oh, nice person, I'll give them some more wealth. So at his command, people flatter donors, and gods are dependent on sacrifice. We talked about this yesterday. The Ritta is connected to the sacrifice, and so the gods live off the sacrifice, that are dependent on it, and forefathers, so when you die and you obtain a heavenly realm, then you're dependent on ancestral offerings. And so it's kind of saying, all this Ritta stuff that we talked about yesterday, there's something beyond that, and this is this imperishable. The previous paragraph is all negative. Here he's speaking positively about him. He's describing things to him. He says, he's doing things. There's characteristics of it. Without knowing this imperishable Gargi, even if a man were to make offerings, to offer sacrifices, to perform austerities in this world for many thousands of years, all that would come to naught. All that would be useless. Pitiful is the man, Gargi, who departs from this world without knowing this imperishable. But the man who departs from this world after he has come to know this imperishable, he, Gargi, is a Brahmin. And so he's redefining also what it means to be a Brahmin. A Brahmin is not someone who performs rituals, as it is for the Vedic ritualist, someone who memorizes the Veda and does the ritual, but is somebody who knows Brahman. That is somebody who is a Brahmin.
And even important, it's not a caste.
Sorry?
It's not even more important, it's not a caste.
Yeah, it's not a caste. Yeah. It's sort of saying, okay, the social conventions we have, there's something more than that that can sort of change these social conventions. And then he reiterates the same teaching, it can't be seen, it can't be heard, and so on. And then finally, Gargi, what does she do? She says, distinguish Brahmins. She again turns to the assembly of Brahmins there. She says, you should consider yourself lucky if you escape from this man by merely paying him your respects. No one of you will ever defeat him in a theological debate. And thereupon, Vajrakandi fell silent. She retreats. Now, she's not admitting defeat here. Again, she's acting as a judge. She's turning to the audience and saying, you guys are incapable of defeating this person. She's not saying anything about herself, notice this. She's not saying, I cannot defeat this person. And a lot of the commentators say, Gargi is superior to Yajnavalkya. She's of a higher realization. That's why they connect her with renunciation. Because they say she's renounced everything. She's given up her... Yajnavalkya is married. He's got two wives, as I mentioned in the beginning. But Gargi, they say, she's an ascetic. She's left everything behind. She's living on a higher level than Yajnavalkya. And therefore, she can act as his judge and almost as his executioner when she has the image of, you know, two arrows. She's going to fire at them. And then, of course, as I mentioned, there's only one Brahmin who still comes forward to challenge him after Gargi gives that declaration, which is Shakalya, whose end is not very good, and he dies. And then Yajnavalkya, in the end, sort of comes out as the victor. So one can, of course, wonder, is he really the victor here? Because Udanaka Aruni and Gargi, are they really defeated? Or are they just merely saying, okay, we don't care about these cows that Janaka is giving to the most learned Brahmin. So we don't have any interest in defeating Yajnavalkya. So we just want him to sort of, you know, treat people fairly. One can question that, you know, what's going on here? Is Yajnavalkya really the winner of this thing or not? I hope sort of this passage gives you a little bit of an insight into the Upanishads. And you can see that it's not just sort of philosophical thought and discussions on the nature of the self, but there's also very interesting stories in here. And as you can see, there's Yajnavalkya and Gargi and Udali Aruni and Ushastha Chakrayana. They can be quite sarcastic and sort of almost irreverent, and sort of saying, what kind of answer is this? You know, this, you really care to suffer me? You say you know, but do you really know? There's a lot of sort of a character in these. They're not just sort of, you know, names in a text, but you can really kind of get a sense of who these people were and sort of their character, which is part of the appeal.
Are these deliberate devices in order to bring across profound philosophical points in a manner which is digestible? Using the techniques used in the of conveying these?
A number of commentators argue that these stories are meant to convey something, either about the way you obtain the knowledge, if it is a guru-disciple relationship that is being described, or in order to praise the knowledge that is being said. And so here, Shankara, for example, in his commentary on this section, on this chapter, he argues that this whole debate is meant to praise the importance of this knowledge that is about itself by associating it with all these learned Brahmins and by showing that all these learned Brahmins are sort of defeated by Yajnavalkya, and therefore the knowledge that Yajnavalkya teaches is more important. Some commentators actually say these are real people and they're important, so they're just sort of records of what happened. And some say, they're records of what happened, but they're also meant to sort of teach something beyond just a mere history of those events.
Thank you very much, Rembert.
Thank you. Thank you.